Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for Wednesday, July 5th. I'm Alan Chartok. Congressman John Faso, Republican from New York's 19th congressional district, is in the studio today. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. Have a question or a comment for Congressman Faso? Give us a ring. We're expecting a ton of calls on today's program, so get yours in early. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Congressman Faso, your calls and more are coming up right after the news. Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Today, we welcome Congressman John Faso of New York's 19th District to the program. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. The first-term Republican serves on the House Budget, Agriculture, and Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. He's a former Republican leader of the New York State Assembly. Congressman Faso graduated from SUNY Brockport and Georgetown University Law Center. He lives in Kinderhook. John Faso, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
Alan, great. Great to be with you again. I think this is the third Vox Pop we've done, and I enjoy it, and I know it. I talked to a lot of constituents who've said to me, oh, I heard you, I didn't like your answer to this, or I liked your answer to that, and it is a great way to reach constituents in the 19th Congressional District.
Well, there are a lot of calls. There are already a lot of calls, and people are lined up to talk to you, to speak with you, and some will be sending stuff in at voxpop@wamc.org, and some will be calling 1-800-348-2551. So we've got a Dave in Sullivan County. All right, Dave, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Alan. Hi, Congressman. Thanks for your time and taking my call.
Sure.
Congressman, a couple questions, of course, surprise, surprise, on health care, accountability, mandate, freedom of choice type stuff. Let me give you the background first. Under either the House or the Senate bill, for those folks with access to the individual market and who can afford but who decide not to purchase health insurance, I think virtually everybody can agree on several things. First, that eventually those folks are going to need health care. That's just the way it is. You live long enough. And a lot of those folks are going to end up on the doorstep of a hospital emergency department. And a lot of those folks are not going to be able to afford the care that they receive in that hospital emergency room department. So the questions really are these. Is it your position that for those folks, because they've exercised their freedom of choice and decided not to buy insurance, that the hospital should say, hey, sorry, go away, get sick, go die?
No, that's not my position. Well, that wouldn't be
okay,
my position.
Okay, let me just get one or two others out, and then I'll keep quiet here. If we believe that the hospital should treat these people and they're not going to be able to pick up the tab, we all know that if for a variety of reasons, those costs get passed on to the rest of us. So where's the accountability for those folks when, in effect, we're picking up the tab for them? And finally, if we think that the hospital should treat them, and if we realize that there really isn't accountability, that it's kind of reckless to not purchase health insurance, isn't it about time that we kind of buck up against the ideology that says, you know, freedom of choice rules everything, and realize that, like taxes and automobile insurance, that sometimes we are better off requiring people to do some things. So your nickel now.
Good. Well, Dave, thank you for the call. You raise a very good point. In the as you know, the individual mandate is highly controversial, and many Republicans, including me, have felt that it was wrong for the government to coerce or force people to purchase something. And remember, when they passed the Affordable Care Act, the argument was that this is not a tax, this is a fee, and it's not a tax, and therefore, if they had called it a tax, they actually wouldn't have been able to get the votes to pass it. And yet, when the Supreme Court, in the 5-4 decision, Sebelius versus, I can't remember who the plaintiff was now, or the something versus Sebelius, in that 5-4 decision, John Roberts upheld the mandate, saying that it was indeed a tax. It was the coercive power of the government to force someone to pay. So that is one of the ironies of this entire process. They could not have passed it if they had accurately called it a tax, and yet the Supreme Court upheld it, saying that indeed it was within the government's power to tax. Now, I agree with you. The burden on hospitals as providers of last resort, and sometimes providers of first resort for some people, is extraordinary. And that's why the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that they did, they were figuring, since we're going to get people to buy insurance, we're going to eliminate the so-called DSH payments, the disproportional share payments that go to hospitals for caring for the uninsured and for those that don't have the money to pay. So they were eliminating those payments to hospitals, those so-called DSH payments. The healthcare legislation that I voted for would eliminate that penalty on, would restore those DSH payments to hospitals in the non-expansion states, but after 2020 would completely eliminate the cuts to those DSH payments for hospitals in the expansion states as well. So this was one of those compromises in the legislative process. But I would note that the ACA was eliminating those payments to hospitals. And many of my hospitals told me that their bad debt and charity numbers really didn't go down after the ACA was enacted. The third point, very briefly, Dave, is that the legislation I voted for has a provision which is a penalty provision in it, which says if you go without insurance and then you want to come in and buy insurance and now you want to use services, you've got to pay a 30% premium as a penalty. So that was an incentive to try to incentivize people rather than penalizing them, incentivize them to purchase insurance, because if they didn't buy it, they'd have to pay a higher premium for a period of a year after they acquire the insurance. So you're right, this is an issue that we're going to be grappling with, and I don't think that there's any clear answer. Some argue that, well, the mandate, you force them to buy and then you really penalize them. Well, 6.5 million people paid the penalty rather than buying the insurance, which was, unfortunately, those were often young, healthier people who we needed in those insurance pools.
Dave, thank you. Okay, let's see. I tried to hang. Dave, are you still there?
Dave?
Yeah, I'm trying to hang that up. Well, you better get somebody else down here, okay? Let's go to Christine in Salt Point. All right, Christine, you're on. Go ahead. Christine? Oh, I see what the problem is. Christine, are you there? Are you there, Christine?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello,
go ahead. Hi, Christine.
Thank you. I would like to ask you, Congressman Faso, why you voted for the House version of the AHCA, even though it would take health care away from lots of Americans. We know it's about 23 million. It would greatly increase premiums for older people. Reduce care for the physically disabled, mentally ill, and addicted, put nursing home care out of reach for many, and send, as our previous caller pointed out, millions back to the emergency rooms for treatment, thereby increasing everyone's taxes, except perhaps the wealth for the wealthiest people, who would get a big windfall. So my question is, how could you, who were elected to represent all of the people of your district, how could you support such a harmful and regressive bill that the overwhelming majority of your constituents oppose vehemently?
Well, Christine, a couple of reasons. One, the Affordable Care Act and many aspects of it are spiraling out of control. We've seen, yes, many people.
No, Christine, Christine, that is not the way we're going to do it. You asked a long question. It was an excellent question. Now we're going to let him answer, okay, without interruption. Go ahead.
So what we've seen, while many people, and I acknowledge, received coverage and under the Affordable Care Act, there were also many people whose coverage has now become unaffordable. The Washington Post fact checker said the biggest lie of the year was the Obama administration promise that if you like your plan, if you like your health plan and your doctor, you could keep them. Turned out not to be true. Many people had their insurance disrupted by the regulatory actions of the Affordable Care Act. We have also seen in recent the last couple of years, and certainly in recent months, many insurers pulling out of entire markets around the country. Now, this is not necessarily has been the case in New York State, but we have seen double-digit premium increases in New York as well. So many people may have health insurance, but if they have a bronze plan, for instance, they often have unaffordable health insurance because their deductibles have skyrocketed and it's unaffordable to them. The second thing is that you mentioned, premiums are going to go up for 50 to 64-year-olds. Well, New York State has a law which is called pure community rating. The ACA had a provision which said that you could charge a 60-year-old three times what you could charge a 20-year-old. The AHCA said you could raise that to up to 5-to-1 if a state chose to do that. And the fact of the matter is, in New York State, we have a state law that's conflicting that says that community rating has to be 1-to-1. You can't charge a 60-year-old more than a 20-year-old. So that argument about raising costs for 50 to 64-year-olds doesn't apply in New York. But I would argue that the ACA number, 3-to-1, is a lot better than where New York is, because it allows for pricing of plans where you get incentivize young people to come into the pools because you're not charging them this enormous burden that they won't pay. And that's why you saw 6.5 million people decide to pay the penalty rather than buy the insurance. Lastly, I would say that the CBO number, and I know a lot of people are transfixed by the CBO number. As I said to Alan earlier, I actually think that the CBO is very good at certain things, like estimating the costs of programs, estimating the deficit on an annual basis, estimating what the national debt will be. Where they're not so good is estimating, well, what will people do evaluating subjective factors in terms of their behavior? And the case in point I would give you is that when the ACA was adopted in 2010, they said 23 million people would purchase policies through the exchanges by 2017. In actuality, fewer than 10 million did. So, and the ACE, and that $22 million or $23 million estimate counts the people who are currently paying the fine, the penalty, rather than buying insurance. Now, it's illogical to me for the CBO to make an assumption that the people who are now paying a fine rather than buying insurance, and when if ACA was changed and this mandate were changed, that they would no longer purchase the insurance, how can CBO classify them as losing insurance? It makes no sense. So, I would say the bottom line for me is that I'm still hopeful that we can come to a conclusion to fix the things that are wrong in the ACA, keep the things that actually work, but do it in a way, and hopefully we can attract bipartisan support to do it, because the best way to do this, to get consensus across the country, is to get Democrats and Republicans to come to a compromise on this issue.
Christine, thank you. We're going to take a little time off here. The turnoff button is not working, folks. Get somebody in here, please. And thank you for that call. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale Retail Shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington, janeiredale.com. Pelham Auto Service at the Amherst-Belchertown line, located by the sign of the Flying Pig, a worker-owned and operated service repairing foreign cars since 1972, pelhamauto.com. And the Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org.
Thank you, Zach, and thank you, John, for being here. We're going to Pa in Cherry Valley. Pa, you're on.
Good afternoon. Hey. I have a question. If the Sasso-Collins Amendment were enacted, enabling the county to reduce the Medicaid portion of my property tax by, let's say, $1,000, then forcing a Democratic governor to raise my state taxes by $1,000, what reason can you give me to believe that my county would see that amount of money returned from New York State to heal the sick and protect the elderly, keep our essential institutions we depend on from bankruptcy? And the other part of my question is, what reason can you give me to believe that the percentage of my property tax that was reduced would be a permanent reduction over the coming years? Because this feels like a shell game to me.
Well, actually, I think your name is Pa.
Yes, it is.
Okay, Pa. Thanks for your call from Cherry Valley. Otsego County, actually, 91% of the county property tax levy goes to pay for mandated Medicaid costs. This is about accountability. The level of government that sets the benefits, that sets the decisions as to how the program is going to operate, should be the same level of government that's responsible for raising the funds to pay for it. And what New York did 51 years ago under Nelson Rockefeller, by the way, the worst mistake Nelson Rockefeller ever made, imposing this county tax burden on property taxes, taxpayers, and homeowners, and commercial property owners. It has helped the exodus of people from New York State because of our high property taxes. It's hurt our real estate values, and it's also diminished the accountability. You know, if 49 other states, virtually all of the other states, can take care of their state Medicaid burden, and this is supposed to be a federal state shared program, if they can take care of it, why can't Albany? The reason is Albany likes getting the money because they don't have to have any accountability for that money. They just basically take it from the counties. Once a month, the Otsego County Treasurer and all the other county treasurers send a check to Albany over a program they have nothing to do with. And this is taxation without representation. To the other point of, is this just a shell game? Well, I would point out to you that New York's Medicaid system spends more than Texas and Florida combined. Now, those two states have more than twice our population. And yet our program, even if you think, well, those two states are stingy with their program, and perhaps you could argue that they are, we are so out of line with other states. The other thing is that there's plenty of room in the Albany budget for cuts and plenty of room for economies. I mean, the Comptroller General of the United States said that there's about $100 billion of incorrect payments every year under the Medicaid system. You could extrapolate that to New York State, saying we have $6 to $8 billion of improper payments in New York State. There's rampant fraud in the Medicaid system. Just a month ago, there was a $25 million OxyContin pill mill in Brooklyn that was all funded through Medicaid. And so I can go through time after time, litany after litany, program after program in New York State and say where we could save money and economize. But the fundamental principle, Pa, is that the level of government which is responsible for the program should be the same one that has to you as a taxpayer and say, we need you to cough up your taxes to pay for this. What Albany has done under Republican and Democratic governors for 51 years, they have played the shell game. They're forcing you in Otsego County and all these other counties. And the thing that people say to me the most in my district when I ran last year, by the way, when I promised I would introduce legislation to do this, and isn't it a novel thing for someone to get elected and actually follow through on what their promise is? And after 4 months in Congress, I was able to get a provision in both the Senate and House bills to end this 51-year monstrosity of these local mandates on the county property taxpayers.
Yeah, but John, wasn't that so that they could get your vote? They gave you this little chestnut that
nope.
You could brag about.
Nope. In fact, this thing, it was an opportunity that I, as an experienced legislator, saw that reconciliation bill going through, and I saw an opportunity to get something that I promised to my constituents when I ran. I was very vocal about it. In fact, my left-wing opponent who ran against me last year, she actually said she supported my idea. So, you know, the fact is that this is, you know, virtually no other state in the country does this to its homeowners and property taxpayers than what New York does. They're really sticking it to people. And
With all due respect, I'm not sure that I feel that I've gotten an answer to my question. You brought up a very serious problem that goes back to the Rockefeller years, and I agree that was a mistake. But here we are with this mistake, and my question is the solution that you propose to me does not look like does not look like a permanent solution. I mean, I think we are going to be paying.
Okay, Pat, you made that.
We're going to be paying a lot more money to New York State, and I don't believe we're going to be paying back.
That's a point.
Here's my rejoinder, Pa, and I thank you again for the call. Is that there's plenty of room in New York State's budget to reduce expenditures that are unnecessary. All the corporate welfare that Governor Cuomo engages in. He spent $41 million this year to send New York State troopers into New York City, which is completely unnecessary, and he did it just out of pique with de Blasio. So there are a lot of areas where we could reduce, economize, reform, and if you believe every single nickel that New York is spending in its $160 billion budget is being spent wisely and with the taxpayers in mind, well, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you.
Pa, thank you. Okay, we'll go. That worked. That's great. Now we'll go to Ken in Catskill. Okay, Ken in Catskill, you're on.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to begin by saying that I am also a graduate of Archbishop Molloy High School, 5 years ahead of you.
Oh, the Stanners. The Stanners.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. I mention that because I remember as you would warm up to go to confession, you would examine your conscience. That was the key to a good confession. I'm assuming you're still an active Catholic, and if you're not, forgive me, and you can tell me, you know, hang up now.
I am.
But, okay, great. My question then becomes, when you chose a party, I'm assuming that you had a genuine, honest motive when you entered politics. How did you choose the GOP? Because I could never even come close to making that decision. And that's my question.
Well, I think you look at the relative merits and the principles. I believe in more limited government. I believe in more the private sector as the generator of the greatest amount of wealth and opportunity for the most people. I believe that I'm not always right all the time. And in fact, I've changed my position on things through the years because I understand that through study and through examination, the things you believed at one point may change your opinion. But I do think that broadly speaking, I fully respect the people who subscribe to a more liberal point of view about the role of government and the role of government in society. And most of those folks are in the Democratic Party. I respect that. I think that the Democratic Party.
Why would that be, if I may ask?
What would that be?
Why would that be, if I may ask?
Why would which be?
Maybe I misunderstood your answer. But people who examine their conscience more closely tend to be Democrats.
Didn't hear that. I think it's a different perspective on what the proper role of government should be. And what the proper amount of government taxation should be, and what the proper role of America is in terms of the national defense and in the world. And I think one of the interesting things, Ken, now, and probably we should invite a Marist brother to come in and negotiate our discussion, since the Marist brothers were the great ones at Archbishop Molloy. But I think that broadly speaking, both political parties represent very legitimate school of thought and a very legitimate school of morality in terms of their viewpoint and worldview. And I would never suggest that one could not be a practicing Catholic and have a morally centered view of public policy and the world and not be a Democrat. Nor do I think it's fair for you to suggest that one could not with the same kind of moral viewpoint and worldview, be a Republican. I think that would be unfair to suggest that.
Ken, thank you. All right. Now I'm going to read one letter that came in here. What political regrets does John Faso have about his votes, and what concerns does he have about President Trump's increasingly alarming behavior?
Well, I don't have any regrets. I mean, look, as I said before to Ken, I mean, I don't view myself as infallible, and I think that I can look back on votes that I may have made in the state legislature years ago and say, well, you know, things have changed. I disagree with that. I'll give you an example. For instance, when I was minority leader, the governor's office, Governor Pataki, came to me and said, we have a public health crisis with people sharing needles and contracting AIDS. And Shelley Silver won't pass the bill because he's afraid for needle exchanges. He is afraid that you will use this as a political weapon to beat Democrats in elections. And so the bill won't come up unless you support it. And, you know, my initial instinct or an inclination was to say, oh, needle exchanges, that's going to give a turn a blind eye to heroin abuse and what have you, and it's not the right moral compass for our children, blah, blah, blah. Well, I sent my staff, my counsel, and others to study this. I studied it with them. We looked at it. I came to the conclusion that properly performed, these needle exchanges could help stem the tide of HIV transmission. So I changed my point of view. It wasn't necessarily the dogmatic conservative point of view that some people accuse me of subscribing to. I changed my point of view. I stood up on the floor of the assembly and argued for it. I had a split in my own conference, but I said we'll bring this bill up anyway. And then Speaker Silver brought the bill up and we passed it. My conference was divided. I supported it. Turned out to be the right thing.
Okay, John, what about the second part of the
question?
Second
part was
President Trump's increasingly alarming behavior towards the press.
To me, it's extremely disturbing. I think the attacks on the media are wrong-headed, and I believe strongly in the First Amendment. I also believe that, you know, polls have showed this, that over 80% of the media vote Democratic. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that I think the media is unbiased. I think there is a bias in certain of the media coverage that you see. And certainly editorial, which is by its nature biased, is often biased against my point of view. But be that as it may, I strongly support the First Amendment. I think that the free press is integral to an informed citizenry. It's integral to keeping the government accountable, keeping public officials accountable. And I think that attacks on the free press are extraordinarily wrongheaded, unfortunate, and regrettable. And I strongly disagree with President Trump's approach in terms of dealing with media criticism. Look, this is fair game. It goes with the territory. And as Harry Truman used to say, if you can't stand the heat, you got to get out of the kitchen.
We'll go to Mark in West Hurley. Mark, you're on.
Hello, Congressman Fasso. My question is very personal. I am father of a 40-year-old woman with severe autism. She's nonverbal. She requires help with every aspect of her life, including eating, toileting, other things. She lives in a group home, Ulster Green ARC. They receive 90% of their funding from Medicaid. If these budget cuts go through, where is she going to live? Where are people with disabilities who live with ARCs and other nonprofits like that? How are they going to live?
Mark, thank you. John McHugh and the Ulster Green ARC and the ARCs around our district do a terrific job. Here's what I would tell you. Every single year under the bill that I voted for in the House, Medicaid will receive more money. It will not receive as much money as had been promised under the Affordable Care Act. And the simple fact of the matter is that we have to be mindful of the fiscal imbalances that we face as a country. So while the program is going to receive increases and actually will not be cut, it will only be deal with reductions of increases that had been promised under the ACA. And I've looked at this closely, and I think that those promises were unaffordable. However, one of the things that we did in the House bill, we increased the amount of money going to the states for people who are disabled and the elderly in nursing home, because I think that the elderly and the disabled and poor children are the most critical constituencies for Medicaid coverage. And I believe that there will be sufficient funds, with the states having more discretion and more control over how funds are allocated. I think there'll be sufficient funds to assist your daughter. Medicaid would would be subject to annual appropriations of the Congress. And I can tell you, rather than being on automatic pilot as it is today, my belief is that if the funding assumptions that we have made were proven to be insufficient, I think Congress would appropriate more money to cover those needs. Because the most critical thing that we have to do is to protect the most helpless people in our society. And the disabled who are living in group homes, people who may be in community residences or living at home and rely upon day treatment activities for the disabled, the elderly in nursing home, and children, those are the most those groups are the ones that I would give the most priority to.
Thank you very much for that very good call. Okay. Now, we'll read one from Jack, who says, in Red Hook, is Representative Faso willing to state unequivocally his agreement with both scientists and U.S. military strategists that climate change is a real and very grave threat to our country, and that Scott Pruitt and Donald Trump have put the nation on a potentially catastrophic path by acting as if climate change were a, quote, hoax? If so, what real actions are you willing to take?
Well, I do believe that climate change is happening. I do think that human activity contributes to that. And I'm a member of the bipartisan Climate Change Climate Solutions Caucus in the House, which has Democrats and Republican members. I supported the one of the things that I'm very interested in is mitigation measures that we should take to harden our infrastructure, to improve our resilience against storms and floods, et cetera. And one of the programs or one of the new initiatives that I'm supporting is a change of the air traffic control system, which would follow a Canadian model, setting up a nonprofit corporation to govern the air traffic control system. It's been very successful in Canada for 21 years. It's worked well. The air traffic controllers support it. The airline pilots and the flight attendants support it. But one of the interesting things is because they would have the ability to fly more directly, point to point, rather than the circuitous routes that are now taken, we would greatly reduce the carbon footprint for jet plane travel in our country. So there are a multitude of ways in which we can actually reduce that carbon footprint and deal with this issue in a responsible way that doesn't hurt our economy. And reforming that air traffic control system is one of those myriad of ways that we could embark upon to have a beneficial effect here.
Okay. And then, why won't Representative Faso attend a town hall meeting in Kingston? The voters want to meet with you in this setting, Paula.
Well, I've been meeting with voters constantly all the time. I've had over 300 meetings with constituents, small groups, and individuals since I took office in January. I had a televised town hall in the northern part of the district for an hour on live TV, where the audience was made up of people who were constituents who got tickets through the TV station to attend. I've tried so far without success to get a similar televised town hall meeting in the lower part of the district. And I've actually talked to a couple of groups about trying to do a community forum of the nature in which you suggest. The one thing that I don't want to do, however, I don't want to contribute to the polarization that is all too rampant in our society today. And it wouldn't be great to have a session where two sides show up and they yell and scream at each other. We have to turn down the volume. And one of the things that I really hope the president changes his mind about tweeting, because sometimes this unnecessarily turns up the volume in terms of the political discourse. We need more civility. And I think that having a session where people would just want to come and wave signs and scream is not conducive to a constituent actually hearing an answer to a question. It's one of the reasons I do Vox Pop, because it allows us to talk to each other and to listen to questions and hear answers.
And we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, Old South Street, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Dairy and No Moo Dairy Free, handmade artisan ice cream, sweet baked goods, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Ken Hicks Construction, specializing in deep energy retrofits, passive house, zero energy homes, and historic restorations, serving Western Massachusetts for over 25 years. KentHicksConstruction.com. Studio Herbage, a contemporary floral design studio in historic downtown Johnstown, New York. Local and long-distance delivery, StudioHerbageFlorist.com. Culligan Water of the Northeast, for over 80 years, providing pure drinking water as well as options for problem water at home and at work. CulliganNortheast.com. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Balsam Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com.
And yet another email. Mr. Faso, will you vote for a health care bill that cuts Planned Parenthood funding as does the current version of the AHCA?
Well, I again, as I've told folks, this depends upon what the final product is. If the final product of a bill is one that I, in the main, agree with, I'll vote for it. And if it's not, I won't.
So there are going to be people out there who think that that's a, now, I hope you don't take offense at this, but a Weasley answer. In other words, that doesn't really answer the question.
The answer is we don't know what the final bill is going to be.
Yeah,
and
I've
actually in the Budget Committee voted for a provision that would have removed the Planned Parenthood language. But the bottom line is I've made it plain to people that that wasn't the ultimate decider for me.
All right, we're going to Sasha in Hurley. Sasha in Hurley, you're on. Sasha.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Hi, this is Sasha. I'm from Hurley, New York. Congressman Faso, I've called your office probably upwards of 30 times, and I just heard you talk about accountability. I could go through my own litany of experiences that I've had calling your office. I've asked you to reach out to Muslims in the district. I saw that you didn't acknowledge the end of Ramadan, which resulted in Eid. My husband and I actually invited you to our home to celebrate Iftar, which is the end of the fast. And I'm just really disappointed in the fact that at a time when Islamophobia is on the rise, you have chosen not to speak out at all about this issue. It's so important to me and my family. In fact, this coming Saturday, I'm traveling to JFK just to be there in case my father's actually traveling abroad, and I'm very worried about the treatment he'll receive when he goes through customs. So I wish you would really consider this issue that I've brought to your attention countless times.
Okay, let's get an answer. John?
Sasha, I'm very sorry. I wasn't aware of your invitation, but why don't you call my Kingston office and relay the fact that we discussed this, and hopefully we can have an opportunity to meet. And certainly I am against discrimination against folks. I actually have gone to the Bangladeshi Muslim services in Hudson twice, in fact, in the last 2 years. And so I agree that I have know the contributions of Muslim Americans to our country. They're part of the fabric of our society, and I fully respect Islam as one of the great religions in the world.
Thank you, Sasha. Okay, let's go to Susan in Saugerties. Susan in Saugerties, you're on.
Hi. Thank you, Alan, for hosting this forum.
Sure.
And thank you, Representative Faso, for agreeing to talk to us.
My
question's about values, and I want to know whether you agree with this or not. Robert Mercer funds the Trump campaign, and his family also helped fund your campaign. And according to an article in The New Yorker, he believes that human beings have no inherent value other than how much money they make. In other words, if he earns 1,000 times more than a school teacher, he's 1,000 times more valuable. So that someone who's on welfare or taking Medicaid or taking food stamps has negative value as a human being. And I think that that has a lot of implications for what goes on in our Congress now under this leadership. And I want to know what you think about that value system, the value that people who take anything from the government are thieves, basically.
Well, I obviously don't agree with that, Susan. I'm not familiar with the article, but I wouldn't agree with it.
It's by Jill Lepore.
Okay, let's let him answer.
I'm not familiar with the article. I'll take a look at it, but I certainly wouldn't subscribe to that point of view.
Well, that's that.
Okay, and his campaign helped you win the election. I wondered if you were aware of that when you were accepting his help.
Well, I'm not. You're correct that Mr. Mercer was a donor to my campaign. You know, there are limits to how much any individual can donate. I think in the last campaign, in which I was outspent by my opponent, I raised about $3 million. But no one individual has any kind of influence over me or my philosophy. Most people, I think, support me because they think that I'm honest and will be forthright and will work hard on behalf of my constituency and the nation. And so, but I certainly can't subscribe to the viewpoint of any individual donor or the hundreds or thousands of people that may have donated to me throughout the course of my political endeavors. It wouldn't be I can't be tagged with something that someone may have said or believed who may be a donor.
Thank you, Susan. We'll go to Eli in Little Falls. Okay, Eli in Little Falls, you're on.
Hi, John. I think it's sad that dogma won't allow Republicans to see that every industrialized nation other than us has universal health care, that they do it more cheaply than we do and more effectively than we do. But to the question that Obamacare is spiraling out of control, that's completely false. There are five states that are struggling to attract insurance companies to their rural counties. They have always had a struggle in those states to attract insurance companies. The Humana Healthcare is estimated that because of this, about 50,000 people are going to lose health insurance. That's not out of control when you compare it to your bill, which takes it away from over 20 million people. That's out of control. But in New York State, healthcare, the system is running extremely effectively. We have 14 insurance companies overall. I think in your district alone, there's got to be a probably just percentage-wise, probably 40,000 people who are going to lose insurance in your district by itself because of your health care bill. I think that's atrocious. And, it's working in New York State. You're a state congressman. It's effective here. We're getting $5 billion a year from the federal government because of that bill. New York State lags tremendously other states in our share of income from the federal government. This is one area, $5 billion that's going to help, that's going to pay for Medicare. And most of that money is a surplus. We don't even need it because we already had the best Medicare going. So it's going to the state fund. Atrocious thing to...
Eli, there are 11 people behind you. John, you want to respond?
No, I think Eli made his point, and I've made my point where I disagree. I think a lot of what he said is accurate in terms of where we are in New York State. I pointed out before that the loss of insurers has not been as significant here in New York as it is in other states. That's true.
Thank you, Eli. Let's go to Christopher in Delhi. Number 10. You're on, Christopher.
Okay, Representative Faso, I was going to follow up Eli's comment with some facts out of the Washington Post fact checker from today's article. You say that there are these problems with Obamacare, with the high premiums, but the fact checker at the Washington Post says that basically the ACA offered better insurance than the pre-ACA insurance, cost a little bit more, and that people who purchased ACA or Obamacare insurance on the market exchanges were shielded, about 80% of them, from the premium hikes. And they also say that the average increase in premiums for 2017 was 25%. Now, if you are under Obamacare, if your co-pays are paid for by the federal government, if your deductible is paid for by the federal government, and if you're just paying the premium, and if it's $69, a 25% increase on that, is you're premium's still going to be under $100 a month.
Premiums aren't $69.
Plan.
Premiums aren't $69, though. I mean, if you look at...
Well, the one I purchased a year ago was. At any rate, my second point I want to make is that the 83 insurers that supposedly abandoned the Obamacare marketplace this year, it turns out it's only 68, and the average number of insurers per, you know, per state is still around the same it was when they began the ACA program in 2014. I think it was about 5 then. It's about 4.3 now, and New York seems to be doing pretty well, and the uncertainty right now seems to be the people leaving the market, the insurers leaving the market, excuse me, I'm jumbled, seems to be caused by the uncertainty from Trump's threats to the ACA and to the subsidies.
Now, actually, Christopher, if I could respond, you know, I think the uncertainty was baked in the cake before Trump became president. And because, remember, these insurers and their rates were filed for 2017, well before, in fact, about May of 16. They were filed well before Trump became president. We're seeing rate increases in New York that range from 8 to about 22%. And I think the fundamental disagreement we probably have is that I don't believe that the ACA, one of the problems with the ACA is they over-federalize the insurance regulatory system. What we should allow, and it could be that the Senate never comes up with a bill because they don't have a political consensus. So here's what I'm thinking in terms of what we would do in that analysis or post this debate. We should allow people to purchase a greater variety of health plans that could be available to them in the marketplace, allow more flexibility away from the ACA mandates, which have driven up costs for many people. The other thing we should allow is we should, just like they have premium support that would subsidize people who might have low income to purchase a policy on the exchange, we should allow a advanced tax credit, advanced refundable tax credit for people to purchase any state-regulated insurance plan. And that tax credit could go towards the purchase of a insurance policy, state-regulated. So if post this debate, if nothing happens, rather than simply allowing the continuation of the status quo, we should have greater flexibility of plan offerings, and we should have the advanced refundable tax credits available to people regardless of whether they buy an ACA plan or a non-ACA plan. I think that would be an improvement on the marketplace. It would allow more flexibility, and it would allow people to purchase plans that would fit what they and their family need. Because, you know, a lot of people, the whole thing, you cite the Washington Post fact checker. Well, the Washington Post said the lie of the year was the Obama administration's lie in 2012 or 13, where if you like your health plan and your doctor, you can keep them.
Okay.
Turned out not to
can
be
I
true.
Respond? Christopher, you may, but you got to keep it short because, again, there's still 10 people behind you. Go ahead.
Under your plan, there's no federal support for the cost sharing and the deductibles. And you could give somebody a free private insurance policy, but if the deductible is $6,300, they're not going to use it.
Okay.
They're not going to be able to use it.
Well, in fact, many people with bronze plans in the ACA have deductibles that are that high. So, I mean, I think we're basically talking about the same thing. How do we deliver a quality product without making it unaffordable for people? And the Affordable Care Act delivered health insurance for people that they didn't have in many cases, but it also disrupted the insurance market for many people that had a plan they were happy with. And so somewhere in between that is a happy medium that we have to come to.
Christopher, thank you for that. Very good call. We'll go now to somebody who's been hanging on for a long time, Andrea in Catskill. Okay, Andrea or Andrea, I'm never sure which. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Andrea from Catskill. Hi, Mr. Fasso. How are you?
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
You've got a minute and a half, and that's it. Go ahead.
Great. Hey, Mr. Fasso. I know that we've talked about healthcare in person and everywhere else many times. What I still don't understand is why Republicans didn't make appropriate changes to the ACA, since you continuously say that you support so many factors of the ACA. Why didn't we help make the ACA better instead of repeal and replace?
Okay, let's take that as the question, and now you got a very short time
for
the answer.
Well, I think, Andrea, that we may actually come to that, as I was just alluding to into my answer to the prior questioner from Delhi, that there are avenues, I think, that if the GOP approach in the Senate fails to achieve a political consensus, there are some avenues that we should approach and hopefully attract Democratic support. And so those are some of the things that I'd like to see: more tax credits, more flexibility in plans, greater variety of plans, and not over-federalizing the insurance regulatory system. But I thank you for the call.
And I thank you for the call, too, and I'm sorry we don't have more time. We are just about out of time. I can't tell you how many people left on the line. Teresa and George and Miles and Joseph and Jim and Christine. And we apologize for that, folks, but it's only an hour and that's all we had.
It's kind of like the Wichita lineman.
It is. I want to thank John Faso of New York's 19th District for joining us on the program today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Maybe Farm, historic site, Rotterdam Junction, New York, presenting Canal Fest, featuring music, animals, and art opening, a canal presentation, crafts, and more, July 15th from 11 to 3, SchenectadyHistorical.org. Nine Pin Cider, Albany, hard cider made from local apples, tasting room featuring New York cider, beer, wine, and spirits, Tuesday through Sunday, now available in Massachusetts, ninepincider.com. And Spate Consulting and Coaching, Shelburne Falls, more than 20 years of working with leaders and teams committed to purposeful change, see it whole, and move it forward, DLSPECHT.com. Bassett Healthcare, providing information on partial knee replacement at educational seminars across Central New York. SayNoToKneePain.com for dates and locations. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. He's John Faso. Stay tuned now for a news update.